Our next case this morning is case number 54069, Exposure Graphics v. Rapid Mounting Display. Mr. Hendricks for the appellant cross-respondent. Mr. Posenberg for the respondent cross-appellant. Mr. Hendricks.
Thank you for giving us this second opportunity to come before this court and argue our case. I am arguing first, it happens to be because my issue on appeal on attorney's fees was the first notice of appeal filed. The other issues involve the reasonableness of the fees, whether or not fees awarded under 18.020 for frivolous defense are recoverable, and then, of course, the punitive damage portion. The last court that entered an order made a comment about offer of judgment and whether or not it was in good faith and the timing was right. And in the decision, Judge Perigary wrote that the offer of judgment came months before we filed a motion to amend, even though we had the information on the motion to amend before the offer of judgment was filed. And I wanted to address the court on that issue specifically because, of course, as a lawyer, that somewhat, you know, smacks a good of bad faith, goes to my credibility. We put that issue before Judge Vega. Judge Vega analyzed it, and she came down on the same point that this court came down on in a case where the federal court heard the case, granted summary judgment. At the same time, there was a state court case going on, and the state court defendant made a motion to dismissed based upon res judicata. The offer of judgment in that case, like this case, was filed prior to the time that the motion to dismiss was filed. And the court concluded that because both parties had equal access to the information, that there was no harm, no foul, that the offer of judgment was made in good faith and had proper timing. Now, in the cases before the court on the issue of the offer of judgment, this case was a very contentious case. It was litigated very thoroughly, very forcefully in some instances. As you know, as counsel who have practiced law, sometimes it's hard to get your client to go the direction that they need to go and spend more money. And as you're developing these concepts with your clients, sometimes the timing of things don't work out to where the offer of judgment is filed or goes along with the motion to amend. But the simple problem with that analysis is that Rapid Displays had all the information that we had. They did everything they could for 3 years to prevent from giving us the discovery that we needed to discover that they had committed these fraudulent acts. We drugged them to settlement conferences to try to settle the case. After I made the offer of judgment and after my motion to amend was granted, I received a letter from Mr. Gantz that is in 361 of the Record on Appeal. And the Exposure or Rapid's counsel says, Exposure Graphics' most recent ploy of attempting to set forth sort of fraud claim is desperate at best. Exposure Graphics has yet to suggest one iota of proof to support the fantastic story that Rapid Display somehow from the outset designed not to produce the entire line of standees, concealed this fact from Exposure, then created the idea of destruction. He goes on in the last paragraph of this letter, because it is clear from your lack of response prior to this date to our request for settlement conference and pretrial attended by principals, we request that you advise your clients of Rapid Display's offer to settle this matter and exchange mutual releases for the amount of $50,000 to be paid to Exposure Graphics. That was after the offer of judgment was filed. That was after the motion to amend was filed and served. That letter was written in an obvious attempt to continue to tell my clients that their case had no merit. And I think after you look what we went through, the fees that were awarded for sanctions on bad faith defense and bad faith counterclaim, you will agree with us that we were fighting an uphill battle. This case is about what was done wrong to my clients from the inception to the end. The other issue on appeal on attorney's fees is law clerk fees. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that because it's a matter of $5,000. Judge Vega ordered as a matter of law that law clerk fees are not recoverable. I've cited cases in my brief that say that other jurisdictions say they are. I don't think the Nevada Supreme Court has ruled on that issue. I'll leave that submitted, but I'd like to save my time to respond to the other issues that Mr. Polsenberg has in the punitive damage argument.
Thank you. Mr. Polsenberg.
Thank you, Justice Terry Dan Polsenberg, for Rapid Displays, which is incorrectly named in the caption. I think that plaintiff started arguing by appeal, so let's go on with that. This is an unusual case, even for me, in that we're here again, 4 years later, addressing the same issue that we had addressed before. And that has to do with, are the punitive damages here excessive? And I think they still are. I don't think they're... Here's... When this case was remanded... I'm going to take an unusual tact in this argument. When this case was remanded, here's what Judge Vega should have done. She should have analyzed the punitive damages in light of the three factors in Bongiovi versus Sullivan and the U.S. Supreme Court's case of BMW versus Gore. She should have first looked to reprehensibility. And as this court had already indicated in its opinion from February 29th, 4 years ago, that the reprehensibility here is not the same that we see in other cases. Now, I hesitate to argue what Evans versus Dean Witter was really about, because I only have the Supreme Court opinion, and that's not always the whole story. But there, you can see, that was a case that involved a fiduciary duty. We're talking about somebody who's holding an elderly, incompetent widow's money and stealing it. And there we're dealing with issues of fiduciary duty. Now, remember, one of the claims we did prevail on was their fiduciary duty claim. We're not in a fiduciary situation here. And frankly, we're not talking about money as we were in Evans, or valuable personal memorabilia and artifacts as we were in Countrywide. We're talking about a product that we destroyed that just didn't sell. I mean, it was 2 months before, the plaintiffs were contacting us, asking us what it would cost to recycle, basically to shred and try to sell the paper pulp. So this is not a situation where we're dealing with, and look at the factors that the U.S. Supreme Court...
What's the standard of review for us in evaluating her determination that the 2.1 ratio or whatever it was that she put on this?
Yes.
What is our standard of review?
I think
on
you have a higher standard of review than deference to the district court. I don't think you review simply for abuse of discretion, because we're dealing with punitive damages. I don't think we go all the way to de novo review, but I don't think that you have to defer to the district court's determination the way you do in compensatory damages. And I think this court's decision 4 years ago shows exactly that distinction, deferring to the district court in compensatories, but saying that the punitive damages were excessive.
Do you make any argument that given the award of attorney's fees and given the economic harm inflicted by virtue of what sort of is a claim that it was abusive claim processing by your client, is there any argument that the punitive damages awards should be taken into account as a factor the availability of attorney's fees, or is that off the table? I mean, there's an assertion in one of the briefs that, in effect, much of the punitive damages sometimes cure otherwise uncompensated economic harm,
Yeah. And
that the attorney's fee awards in this case do, and that we either should or should not consider that as a factor in assessing punitives.
That's interesting, because the court and I have debated a lot where the analysis of attorney's fees and punitive damages converge, and I think you can see it here. Their argument also seems to be, when they're discussing the California Roby case, that the punitive damages seem to be to compensate for uncompensable non-economic harm like emotional damages. But let me take it step by step. I think their claim here is only for economic damages. And they were fully reimbursed for economic damages. I think they were more than fully reimbursed for economic damages, Justice Pickering, because what the district court did here, remember originally she was going to award $14 per unit. And then we were able to discover after the close of the presentation of evidence, as the judge says, that they had hidden from us and from the district court a bulk sale of 2,000 items at $4 each. Now, those of us who understand Article 6 bulk sales know that that's the lowest possible price you're ever going to get for it. And we demonstrated it at trial. They were never able to sell anything else. So I argued to this court 4 years ago that $4 was too much. The panel at that time
said... But you lost that argument.
Excuse me?
You lost that argument.
I did.
So we cannot revisit that, right?
Well, I'm not asking you to revisit it. I'm not asking you to change it or lower it. In fact, I've already, you can see in the file, there's a satisfaction of judgment where I've already paid $404,000 on this case. So what you can look at is whether it contains purely, they argue it's purely economic harm. Let me get back to that in a second. I argue that it's more than that. I argue it's inflated compensatory damages. And so it does fall under Roby in the fact that you do have a situation here where the compensatory damages more than awarded their economic damages. And so it shouldn't be viewed as the basis for a two-times multiplier. Let me get to my point about economic damages, and they argue these are purely economic damages. That is exactly what Campbell, the factors that Campbell set out is. You use a much lower, and I would argue the high point, we're looking at a range of 0 to 1 times compensatory damages where we're dealing with purely economic harm. And when we're dealing with, it's not an issue of health or safety of the plaintiffs. There's no personal injury here. I understand if we were dealing with people having been injured, the multiplier would be higher. But what the judge did was she looked at their emotional injuries. On remand, the order doesn't analyze the factors under Campbell and BMW and under Bongiovi. What it talks about is these poor plaintiffs wanted to start a company and be their own bosses and have economic security, and their mother lent them money, and they're all in a terrible emotional state because of this. That's not the analysis under punitive damages. You look at what the defendant did, not at what the plaintiff did. And if you look at what the defendant did here, all we did was trash 9,000 out of 26,000 non-selling products. Now, I think if the district court used the right analysis, she would have come to a punitive damage amount of roughly...
But isn't there also a factor that she felt there was dishonesty as far as coming to clean account of...
Yes, and let me address that as long as you bring that up. There are really three items of damages that they recovered for in their compensatory damage award. The judge specifically broke out the $15,000 that we charged them for storage. Now, I think that was a legitimate charge. We were storing their product. The judge said we had it 99% assembled. It was the job was essentially completed. It was printed. It was mounted. The easels weren't put on, and they weren't put in boxes on some of the items because it took up less room in the warehouse. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't completed. That doesn't mean that they don't have to pay storage charges. I understand I lost that, and I lost it on the first appeal. But that's $15,000. And if you're going to use it even as a basis for punitive damages, that misrepresentation claim, then no, that it should only be based on the $15,000, not the entire $120,000. The other $105,000 were for the 26,000 standees that couldn't be used anymore. 9,000 of them were the ones that we trashed. The others, they claim, were mishandled, were mutilated, were folded, that there was mold, so that they couldn't use them. But the only thing that any of our intentional conduct would have gone to is the 9,000 standees that were shredded. And that would be 9,000 times 4, now warning, math's involved, so that's 36,000. You wouldn't base the punitive damages on the entire $120,000 amount. I get to $80,000 two different ways. I argued in the district court that it's the appropriate scale under the federal decisions, and yes, I rely on some of the California decisions. It is 0 to 1 times punitive damage, compensatory damages. And I said they should fall in the middle of that range.
Did you make that argument on the first appeal?
I don't believe I made that argument, no, and it was remanded to the district court to determine what the amount should be. And in the district court, I don't remember if I made it, but I do remember making it in the district court.
But on the first appeal, I'm concerned about law of the case in this case because I'm concerned about law of the case in this case and what the arguments were on the first appeal. You must have argued punitives were not available at all.
I did argue that.
And then you argued that they were constitutionally excessive.
Constitutionally and as a matter of state law, because I rely a great deal on the Ace Truck Company case.
Okay. So when
this court did find that they were excessive, it sent it back down.
Yes, it did. But when it sent it back down, what we're looking at now is did the district court exceed its discretion on the remand issues?
I think it did exceed its discretion. I don't think it utilized its discretion. I think it did everything it could to reinstate its original determination. And I have been so bold as to say in the opening brief that the district court ignored this court's direction to it.
And so, that's precisely the point. Tell me how it did that. Tell me how it defied the mandate from this court on the first appeal. That's the issue I want to hear about.
It's all the district court did was look at ways to reinstate the original punitive damage award. The district court even awarded more than they had asked for on remand, where she said that two times is not sufficient. I'm going to award 2.1 times. It's a result-oriented decision here, and this court's website points out that I raised in footnote 12 the argument that if this case is going to be remanded, it shouldn't be remanded to the same district
judge. Mr. Poulsenberg, did the district court expressly or impliedly consider on remand the financial condition of the defendant?
Expressly pointed out in its order on remand that we were worth, that the overall corporation, not the Union City plant, was worth $24 million, which was not part of
it. A factor which is not included in Bongiovi.
No, it is not.
Did you argue that that's error?
Yes, I did. And I argued two things on punitives. I don't think it should go back to Judge Vega if there is a remand. And I'm going to, as long as I'm being bold, I don't think there should be a remand. This court in Ace and in several other cases that I've cited in other courts actually do the cutting of the punitive damages itself. But if you do remand, I think we need another judge. Let me hit attorney's fees and try to make the segue into Justice Pickering's analysis there. I don't think attorney's fees are appropriate here at all because I think that you have to have a high punitive damage award to beat their offer of judgment. I think the punitive damage award here was designed to beat their judgment so that there could be another almost $500,000 in attorney's fees. They make the argument that the judge said everything we did was violated 18.0102B. Well, that wasn't what the judge originally said. That wasn't what their motion for attorney's fees was. Their motion for attorney's fees, based on general misconduct, were based on specific things in the litigation, the job envelope, certain court orders. It was not an overall, and you look at the things I prevailed on. You can't say these are insignificant and think we should get attorney's fees under 18010. They should get attorney's fees against us. We prevailed on fiduciary duty. We prevailed on the damages issue where they thought they should get 14 items, $14 per item and instead of four. The judge said, and I hear plaintiffs say it just now at the lectern, that we knew all the facts before the offer of judgment. Yeah, we knew all the facts before. It was in their original complaint. Their original complaint did set out that we had billed without the job completed, which is their position. They did set out that we destroyed these items, but it set them out as commercial claims, as breach of contract claims, as breach of bailment claims, as conversion claims. And conversion doesn't need a bad state of mind, as this court pointed out in Cantorino and in Ace. So this is not a situation where we were in anything other than a commercial case.
Well, I appreciate the advocacy nature of counsel's letter that was read here.
Yeah.
But that communicates to me an awareness that this has an exposure of punitive damages, at least when considering the offer of settlement, one would have escaped even that risk?
This is the letter he's talking about at 321. I would have to look and see what timing that is, because what the part he read said that it had to do with them claiming that they were going to bring a fraud claim. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like it had to do with the amendment, which was in April of 2003,
correct,
rather than the offer of judgment was in December of 2002. So I would check that, but I would also say that this is a business case. This should have been a business court case. This shouldn't have been a case that had the kind of result that this case had. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Pillsbury. Senator, you have about 10 minutes and 15 minutes.
Mr. Hendricks, before you get too far down the road, the question I have is pretty much the same one I was asking Mr. Polsenberg. 180102B includes language that it is the intent of the legislature that the court award attorney's fees and impose sanctions in all appropriate situations, and now I'm quoting, to punish for and deter frivolous or vexatious claims and defenses. That's 180102B, and you're getting attorney's fees under that, and you did on remand on an expanded motion for attorney's fees. To my mind, I'm not sure that the ratio is really 2.1 to 1 on punitives, whereas in this case, it's primarily an economic damage case. And whether or not the availability and addition of the fees should be calculated in our review of the punitive damages awarded in this case. Long question, and I apologize for it, but that to me is the difficulty I'm having with your position.
Sure, and I understand that, and that's a very good question. The problem that exists with the inherent nature of the question is the punitive damages go to the issues in the conduct before the lawsuit is filed. The lies, the deception, the cheating, the sending invoices saying we have 30,000 standees stored on, number of pallets that if you box them up, that's how many standees are going to be on those pallets. Totally misrepresenting that they're going to be done. The vexatious litigation is saying exposure, you destroyed the standees, you told us to do it, we aren't liable. Two different analysis. One is we're entitled to fees because you had to take us through this process. Had they came to us and said, we admit that we converted your standees. We admit that. So let's fight about value. That's a completely different issue. And that's why you have to separate them out. There's cases out there that specifically hold that you can't put punitive damages in the calculation of what your ratio is going to be, but as far as what punitive damages are, therefore the conduct before, not the conduct during.
Okay, so following your point, explain to me if we subtract out the litigation conduct issues, how a 2.1 to 1 ratio is appropriate on the damages. That's piece two.
The question that is at the heart of this lawsuit, Your Honor, this is a case of fraud and deception. And contrary to Mr. Polsenberg, we alleged all those allegations. We said they were fraudulent. The district court judge said, yes, they were fraudulent. We chose a conversion method of damages for the reasons that we did, but the fraud was found and it was held.
But the reprehensible conduct, in assessing that as a factor.
Yes.
Describe for me, make your best case for the reprehensibility of the conduct and what the district court relied on in determining it.
The first reprehensible nature is that Mr. Wilson, who was a new plant manager, decided to do certain things with our standees, not complete them, store them in pallets, and then he made a unilateral decision to destroy them. Earl Abramson, the owner of the company, this is a family-owned company, Earl Abramson, the owner of the company, was told by my client's sales rep at Rapid, hey, Dave Wilson, your plant manager, destroyed my people's standees, put them in the shredder. And I want you to know that on the day that the shredder started, on the day that it was stopped, the judge found that 26,000 standees were destroyed on that day, not because they were stored differently. But from that point on, Earl Abramson ran with the ball. Earl Abramson was the one that hired the lawyer to say, to write me a letter and say, your client was the one that ordered that the standees be destroyed. Earl Abramson was the one that manipulated how they were going to go about handling the destruction of the standees and getting my clients compensated by simply giving them more product, remanufacturing the product, and not taking ownership of what they did. Mr. Earl Abramson engineered the fraud behind the doors himself. This is what makes this case not necessarily like trucking. This makes this case more akin to Evans, and that's exactly what the district court judge said. There was culpability at the top here. There was people that knew what was going on who were in positions to stop it. You have Mr. Dave Wilson who's writing a letter and say, hey, guess what? We destroyed these standees, and now we get to keep the shredding money from it. We have Mr. Wilson is talking to Mr. Abramson, and Mr. Abramson is telling Mr. Wilson, well, go out there and mitigate our losses. Don't confess to anything. Keep telling Rapid, keep telling Exposure that they ordered the destruction of the standees. That's the fraud. And it was perpetrated from January 26, when it was found, clear until the time the lawsuit was filed, Your Honor. It was perpetrated, it was perpetrated, it was perpetrated. Not once did anyone ever say, we're going to take ownership. Not once can they say this was a low-level management decision. Once the destruction happened, Kirk Carnes called the owner of the company and said, this is what happened, and he took ownership, and he continued to act the way he did. And the way they acted is evident in the January 23rd, 2003 letter that I wrote to this court. The arrogance is there. And that's why there was punitive damages awarded against them for the pre-conduct, and there was vexatious defense attorney's fees that were awarded after the conduct. And I want the court to know that when the court originally found in its order awarding attorney's fees, it held that Rapid's defense was frivolous from the inception. Probably bad lawyering on my part that I didn't get that award initially, but this court directed that that might be an option, and we did that. Your Honor, we have done everything right in this case. My clients were vulnerable. That's the key issue. These people were sophisticated. Judge Vega did take into consideration the net value of $24 million. That happened before the case ever went to the first appeal. That was part of the record. She had that before her, and that was a determination that she made. I don't see anything in Bon Jovi that says that she can't take that into consideration, but I see all the public policy arguments that say that punitive damages are designed to do what? To punish, to defer future conduct. How do you defer the future conduct of a $24 million company unless you award something that's going to wake them up? In Ace Trucking, we can look at the factors, but the court said the award of attorneys of punitive damages in Ace Trucking was 30% of their net value. Punitive damages is not designed to put someone out of business. It's designed to punish them. That's not the case here.
Mr. Hendricks, may I interrupt?
Sure.
On page 9 of the order of remand, the panel specifically noted that the reprehensibility in this case was markedly different than the reprehensibility in Evans. The court, the district court, by equating the reprehensibility on remand to Evans, seems to be directly at odds with the conclusion, rightly or wrongly, but the conclusion that the panel arrived at. Was that error?
No, Your Honor, it's not error, because you know, if you take and you read Justice Springer's decision in Ace Truck, he goes, you know what, when we were all kids, we knew right from wrong, and we were able to make determinations and decisions in good faith based upon our understanding from right from wrong. Judge Vega tried to take Ace Trucking, Evans, Countrywide, which the people in Countrywide, it's a 3-to-1 ratio where their personal belongings were thrown out, and come to a consensus of what she thought punitive damages. To say that she relied solely on Evans, I don't think so. She made an analogy to Evans.
Well, my concern is that on remand, especially from her stated point of view that this is akin to Evans. That seems to be contrary to what the direction on remand was. But it also appears that she, again, considered the net worth of the defendant, which is not one of the Bongiovi guideposts. In fact, we've had quite a debate about that issue, as you know, as to whether it should or should not be part of the factors to be considered in awarding punitive damages. And given those circumstances, I'm just trying to determine, this isn't about you and your lawyering and your client. This is about the district court's consideration of this case on remand and whether there was error in assessing punitive damages. And so in the context of the question that Justice Pickering asked, why wouldn't we find error where the district court says, I still view this as akin to Evans, when the panel said it's not? And why wouldn't we find error when the district court says, I'm going to still consider a factor that isn't included in Bongiovi?
The factor being the dollar value.
The net worth of the defendant.
Well, Your Honor, I haven't read a case yet that says that the net worth cannot be considered. Mm-hmm. You know, Bongiovi has its factors, and it doesn't say in there that the old factors that Nevada adopted couldn't consider net worth. Then it adopts the State Farm factors, but in adopting the State Farm factors, it can't say that the district court can't consider net worth in making its conclusion. So there's no direction there. And it, you know, if this court feels inclined to do that, I really think that the only way you can punish is to know net worth. The three-prong guideline that's set out is for this court to say, are the punitive damages reasonable in light of the factors? And the 3-to-1 factor by itself puts a cap on what the punitive damages
are. Hasn't this court recognized, though, a difference between business transactions and, say, fiduciary duty in the Jaffe-Bros context, for example?
Yes, this court and all the other courts, Your Honor. And it's a true prong deal. In Bongiovi, there was a 1-to-1 ratio, and, you know, part of that was because there were highly awarded, you know, the emotional type damages. And there's a long line of cases out there say, well, when you're awarding emotional type damages, that's when maybe you don't award so many punitive damages because the emotional considerations are already being compensated for.
But it looks like from the record, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, I'm just trying to explore this so I understand your position, but it looks like the district court on remand continued to be influenced by the emotional stress created by this circumstance on your clients. Maybe that isn't an appropriate distinction, because having represented clients in a number of business cases, oftentimes those can be just as emotional as clients who are going through the horrific problem of family cases. So maybe that's not a fair distinction, but we seem to be making that distinction, and the district court judge seemed to continue to be influenced by the emotional stress on your clients created by this case.
Briefly, if you read the Gore factors on the rehabilitability factor, vulnerability is one of the other five factors that mm-hmm. Gore sets out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's clearly appropriate for the judge to figure out. You know, two 18-year-old boys go to a company who says, hey, we're dad, come on over here, give us your money, and we'll take care of you. They were vulnerable. She's entitled.
So you'd characterize this as the company having taken advantage of the vulnerable nature of their customer?
To secure their business, yes. Mm-hmm. But as far as damages go, I mean, it's an economic tort. I'm not going to misrepresent that fact to the court. But I think the 2-to-1 is a very reasonable ratio. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for their arguments in this matter. Briefs. This matter will stand submitted. I think we're recessed till like 1:30.